Are you looking to give your immune system a boost? This is Dr. Ronald Hoppen with a natural solution from Future Farm Botanicals, liquid wild oil of oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's wild oil of oregano supports a variety of health benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate wild oil of oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. Future Farm sources this product from the Mediterranean and produces it in the United States. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today our guest comes to us all the way from Australia. She is Kate Grenville. She's one of Australia's most celebrated writers. She's a fiction writer. But she's turned her attention to a very serious nonfiction subject in her new book, The Case Against Fragrance. And she speaks from personal experience, as you can learn in part one of today's podcast. She herself was afflicted by sensitivity to fragrance. And the question came up in part one, what about natural fragrance? You know, we have natural essential oils, incense, aromatherapy. These things are highly touted in integrative medicine, natural medicine, as being therapeutic, as being safe. What's the deal on that?
It's interesting you mention aromatherapy. Aromatherapists, of course, know perfectly well that many natural essential oils and other odors are, in fact, not good for us. I've been on many of the very respectable aromatherapy sites, and there are lists of things to avoid. Do not put these on yourself. Do not use these if you are pregnant, etc. Mm-hmm. So,
I believe there's actually a knock on lavender oil, which is a very popular aromatherapy oil, but that it has estrogenic effects, that it may induce feminization if used as a topical oil in young boys, for example. There's been some cases of gynecomastia or breast development in young boys associated with the use of these, quote, natural oils.
That's right. I think there haven't been enough studies on that to be absolutely positive one way or the other. But I note that one of the very authoritative sites that I looked at, the American Cancer Council, something like that, suggests that just as a precaution, people with cancer not use lavender oil. So even though all the proof is not yet in, one way or the other, many people are saying let's follow the precautionary principle here, and just in case, avoid it. So that's the first thing to say, that actually aromatherapists know what is true, which is that many of these things are by no means harmless. Just because they're natural doesn't necessarily mean that they're safe. After all, the most toxic poisons in the world, like deadly nightshade and so on, are perfectly natural. They just happen to be fairly deadly. So when people make natural odors like essential oils or concretes, what they're doing is compressing the tiny little fraction of smell in, for example, a rose, and multiplying it by thousands and thousands of times. It takes something like 4,000 kilos of roses to make about a teaspoonful of rose absolute or essential oil. So that's the kind of proportion we're talking about. Now, that is actually, in a way, it's perfectly natural. That's from a rose. But in another way, it's completely unnatural. Nature did not intend us to have the equivalent of 44,000 roses up our nose at once. It intended us to smell at most probably a dozen. So although they are natural, first of all, some of them can still be toxic, and also the very fact that they have been so ruthlessly concentrated makes them in effect unnatural. Now, I think the proportion of the chemicals in them are at least still what nature intended and what we evolved to deal with. So it's really just a matter of the concentration. So many people with my sort of problem find that they can tolerate very small amounts of essential oils, but many other people can't. So one has to treat them with caution. And when a product says uses botanicals with natural essential oils, etc., the only way you can actually check their claim is to read the label very closely. Now, on the label, if, in fact, all those chemicals are from natural sources, they will be named on the label because they will have cost more, and the manufacturer will want you to know the exact species of rose that your fragrance came from. Mm. On the other hand, if they're synthetic, if the fragrances are synthetic, or if there is some synthetic mixture in there, the manufacturers will be allowed to use just one word, fragrance or parfum, legally to cover anything up to a couple of hundred other chemicals, which do not have to be named individually. So even if you know, even if I knew, for example, which individual chemicals were upsetting me, there's no way that I could look at the label and think, oh, well, okay, that one contains it, so I'll avoid it.
Yeah. You know, there's an interesting point in your book where you discuss what happens when we camouflage our natural odors. You know, humans have distinct smells. In fact, that's the way that babies bond to their mothers, and lovers attract one another via pheromones. Are we confusing our basic biology when we use deodorants and scented soaps and products to camouflage our natural odors?
Certainly, when you do research on what smell is for, you know, why are we able to smell smells, and why do we produce smells ourselves in our own bodies? I came away completely convinced that these are very important signals. Apparently, it has been, you know, well established that human beings subliminally, subconsciously, at an unconscious level, can pick up by smell alone people who are first-degree relatives, you know, fathers, mothers, brothers and sisters, etc. Now, this is clearly a very good safety mechanism that nature's put in place so that we can avoid incest and all the problems that cascade down from that. There have been a lot of researchers of the sweaty T-shirt variety showing how people are, they sound very strange. I'm kind of glad I wasn't one of the subjects of those. People are invited to sleep in a T-shirt for a couple of nights without washing it, and then the sweaty T-shirt is given to members of usually the opposite sex, I think, to see. And there's no question that there are significant things going on in terms of attraction and lack of it. So, and of course, as you say, our babies, within 1 hour of birth, mothers can detect their baby just by smell alone. Uh-huh. Now, that is an extraordinary thing. Most of us don't realize that. What that means is that this stuff is very powerful. We were given that sense of smell and given the production of smells ourselves for good biological reasons. And I can only say that we go against that at our peril. We don't know what's happening. Now, you could say that because, you know, if you have a generation of babies, for example, who've grown up only knowing the artificial smells that their mother has slathered on herself and also on the baby, that fabulous sense of bonding and security and reassurance that a baby gets from recognizing the smell of its mother, something as primitive and basic as that, if a baby is deprived of that, what is that going to do to its very profound and kind of reptile brain development? Is it going to grow up without that fabulous sense of reassurance and, okay, this is where I belong? If you never have that feeling, if you're only ever smelling, you know, something out of a bottle, what is that going to do to you as an adult? We can only speculate.
Very interesting point, yeah. But don't you need fragrance to make an effective deodorant, for example? I mean, you know, in New York, I don't know, perhaps in Sydney and Melbourne, we're crowded into subways and strap hangers are, you know, up close and personal. Don't we want to use something? And are there safe alternatives?
Well, there are many safe alternatives for deodorant and just about everything else. I mean, I use a deodorant which is completely fragrance-free and, as far as I know, completely effective. Nobody has ever told me that it wasn't. The shops are now full of fragrance-free products for the reason that many people, without even knowing the science, which is scary once you do know it, but without even knowing the science, people are kind of instinctively starting to veer away from this kind of planet fragrance, this overwhelmingly fragranced world. Yeah. So actually all those things can be quite effective. There was an interesting law case not too many years ago in the US, in Detroit, a woman whose colleagues refused to stop wearing fragrance, actually collapsed at the desk from her problem with it, and had to give up work. But instead of just going gently into that good night, she sued her employer for not giving her a workplace that did not make her sick, and she won a very large payout.
Susan McBride case?
That's right. A very famous case in the US. I wish we had one here, because what she did was ensure that many, many public buildings in the US, as you probably know, particularly government ones, now have fragrance-free or low-scent policies, which is a fantastic thing. But to loop back to the deodorant issue, this is supply and demand working. Within a day of that being announced, representatives of the people who make fragrance-free deodorant were standing at the doors of those office blocks issuing free samples to the workers to prove that actually the workplace was still going to be perfectly all right without fragrance.
Capitalist ingenuity. There's always enough market opportunity. But you know, so one might ask, you know, haven't most of these chemicals been safety tested? Surely there are certain standards that the industry has to adhere to.
You would think so, wouldn't you? I mean, in a world where you can't buy a loaf of bread without seeing that it contains wheat, or even a pint of milk without discovering that it contains milk, the labelling laws are so strict. But in the case of fragrance, as I said before, the labelling laws are not strict at all because of the trade secrets loophole. So they're not required to announce all the chemicals. Now, in the case of regulation, you know, people often say here in Australia, oh, we live in the nanny state. You know, government's looking after too much. Well, I can only say, where is Nanny when we need her? Because there is, in effect, almost no regulation on these chemicals. Many of them have never been tested. Many of them have only been tested by the fragrance industry. They may or may not be publishing those results. So these are chemicals which we have up next to our skin every day of the week, and they have not been tested for safety on humans by anybody. The fragrance industry does do a lot of tests on fragrance. It does them, of course, on rats and mice, mostly because it's pretty difficult to subject humans to the kind of thing that you have to subject animals to. So almost many of those chemicals have been tested on rats and mice, which is a problem because rats and mice are like us in some ways and they're not like us in other ways. So that's the first problem, that those tests are not about the effect on human beings. The other problem, of course, is that those tests are the basis for the fragrance industry saying, oh, yes, look, we know some of our chemicals are carcinogens and we know some of them are gender benders and we know a lot of them give you skin allergies and other forms of problems. But we've done tests on rats and mice and we've come up with a percentage of these chemicals that won't do you any harm at all, perfectly safe to have this percentage of the carcinogen. So the FDA in the US, you know, they have to err on the side of not just caution, but extreme conservatism. So the onus is on the people who are suffering from the chemical to prove that it is bad. A chemical is innocent until proved guilty. That's the state in the US, and it's also the same in Australia.
There's a concern about formaldehyde as a potential either an ingredient or a byproduct of the degradation or combination of so many ingredients because, you know, what goes into the bottle actually, you know, could be a chemical reaction in the making because, you know, it's 1 + 1 + 1 plus, you know, 99 other ingredients. It's a real chemistry set, and ultimately you could get byproducts that you don't even anticipate.
That's exactly right. And in fact, in many cases, we know for sure there's a whole very common class of fragrance chemicals, of which, for example, pinene is one, which when they're exposed to the air, grab onto the oxygen molecule, atoms in the air, combine with it, and make formaldehyde. So that is a well-established and uncontroversial scientific fact. The only disagreement arises as to what amount of formaldehyde is bad for you. It's a bit like those tests of the carcinogens. There's no question that the formaldehyde, which is in excessive amounts a deadly poison for humans, although a slow-acting one, there's no question that the stuff is bad. So, can there be an amount that is okay? Well, possibly, but if there is, we don't actually know what it is because the tests are not done on humans. And also, we don't know when we've exceeded it because in the normal course of a day, we're exposed, for example, to an enormous amount of pinene in cleaning products that smell like a pine forest, that kind of thing.
Yep.
That's an uncontrollable, unknown, unquantifiable amount of that stuff. So even if there were a safe level, we can't know when we've exceeded it. So the whole notion of regulation, I mean, I found that astonishing because I thought, 21st century, we have governments and we have regulators who look after us. You know, it may not have to be the nanny state, but we know that as citizens, we're entitled to be kept safe. But this is absolutely not so in the case of all these fragrance chemicals.
Well, you actually in your book make an analogy to smoking bans, and you say, quote, people have the right to breathe air that doesn't make them sick. So do you see a case for more legislation that protects people from inadvertent exposure to these chemicals or regulations? I mean, it's not a matter of simply of personal choice. If you don't want to use them, you don't have to. But these things are being imposed upon us by other people's choices.
That's right. I think legislation, or at least, legislation is always a problem. But those workplaces in the US and particularly in Canada, Canada is full of fragrance-free hospitals, universities, all that kind of thing. That proves that it can be made to work if an institution has a policy to be fragrance-free or low scent. It works. The employees absolutely have a right not to be made sick by their workplace. I mean, we look back in horror at the 19th century and people, getting shocking disorders from breathing phosphorus and so on in factories. So people in an office have an equal right not to be made sick by the air that their employer is providing. The smoking ban, in a way, was a bit easier because you can tell when someone's smoking. You can actually see it happening.
Yeah.
And you can send
it out. It's a very discreet problem. It's, cigarettes and cigars and pipes cause that. And it's not like there are not so many sources of cigarette smoke. I mean, when we're talking about fragrances, we're talking about everything from toothpaste to aftershave to laundry detergent to, personal deodorants to perfume counters and many, many other sources of problems. There's actually, you point out something interesting, and this is sort of part of, I guess it's a giant psychology experiment that we're all guinea pigs in, is we have ambient scented stores where fragrances are literally pumped into the air system with the belief that this could enhance purchasing by customers. What's up with that?
Yeah, that's right. I was told this by so many people. They've done studies. That's always how it starts. They've done studies that show that people spend more money and buy more in shops that are fragranced. So I went looking for that study, and it took me a very long time. Finally, I tracked it right down to its source, which was an announcement in a press release by, surprisingly, the people who actually make fragrance.
Yeah.
And they were asked, well, what exactly is this study? Can we have a look at this study that shows this fact? Oh, no, that's commercial in confidence. We can't show it. So this whole myth has grown from the kind of head of a pin of a little press release to this kind of received wisdom, as in so many other things. People believe it without questioning it. So as a result, I mean, it's not just department stores that are now saturated in fragrance. Every little shop along every clothes shop feels that they have to have a scented candle
yeah.
or a fragrance diffuser, what I think of as stink sticks. Now, what they don't realise is that research has been done here in Australia that says 20% of the population will immediately turn tail and walk out of a shop with fragrance.
Yeah.
I know I certainly do. The third of the population that knows they get sick from the stuff. So, in fact, all those poor shopkeepers, far from making more money, are actually losing it.
That's interesting, but it still has the aura of some sort of added value. So can you point our listeners in the direction of some additional resources? Lots of resources are compiled in your book, The Case Against Fragrance, which, of course, is available internationally. It's published in Melbourne, Australia, but it's an internationally available book. Are there websites, are there resource sites that help people identify fragrance-related issues, that make them more aware of this issue, or that also point them in the direction of fragrance-free alternatives?
Yes, the fragrance-free alternatives, of course, would differ from place to place, but I can only say that here in Australia, the market is now speaking, and manufacturers are responding. It's now, even in mainstream supermarkets, possible to buy all sorts of fragrance-free things. So that's something I suggest people just go looking, probably not at eye level in the supermarket. It'll be up on the top or down at the bottom because the makers won't have paid the extra for having their product at eye level. But you may well be able to find, for example, a fragrance-free laundry detergent in your supermarket. If not, health stores or drug stores can often sell these alternatives, and, of course, they're all online. As for more information, probably the book, I mean, I did some very serious heavy-duty research. My daughter's actually a scientist, so she gave me a great deal of help and a great deal of sort of entree into scientific studies. So the book is a bit of a resource. One of the things I think the book might have as a use, you know, the most awkward conversation in the world is the one that says, I'm really sorry, but the way you smell is making me sick. That's a really awkward conversation to have, for example, indeed, with the person at the next desk in your workplace. So one of the uses for this book, I think, might be that it can just be left lying around ever so casually for those people to read. It is, I think, all about awareness. My feeling is fragrance has become a habit and a taken-for-granted thing in our world. Let's stop making it a habit. Let's make it a choice. Let's actually think about it and make it a choice.
That's a good point. And this is a good point at which to leave off our conversation today. The book is The Case Against Fragrance by Kate Grenville. I recommend it very highly. It's a very authoritative discussion of all the issues related to fragrance, the science behind fragrance and the potential harms. And, you know, you've launched a new literary career because you were a fiction novelist, and you now you're sticking to the facts, and you're doing an admirable Yes. job at it.
Thank you very much.
You're certainly getting the word out about a very, very important issue. Thank you so much for joining us, Kate Grenville.
Thank you. It's been lovely to be on the show.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.